Welcome back to another episode of Preacher in the Hat. There's been, we're filming this in the early parts of March, so there's been a lot of buzz these days as we just released our first episode to the public. So if you were seeing that around this time, we had had a lot of good response to that. So it's been fun, kind of jumping in on that. We have a whole lot of stuff out there now for folks, so make sure you're looking at preacherinthehat.com, our website. We've got a newsletter, and you can join us on Facebook, YouTube, all that kind of good stuff, or wherever you're watching or listening right now. So we're glad to have all that cool stuff out there for you. But I wanted to start off today with an interesting question, and I won't hold you guys to naming all the people on this list. Some of them I don't think I even knew. But I wanted to see if you could, if anybody comes to your mind when you think of people who have become famous, or, you know, I guess they wouldn't necessarily have to be famous. You could have a somewhat local example, but people who have made it big, who maybe didn't make it big to start with, or, you know, failed in some capacity as they were getting going in whatever it is that, that they do. Is there anybody that you think of that comes to mind with those sorts of things?
Steve Jobs before Apple.
Not even before Apple.
Yeah.
Apple fired him.
Yeah, that's right.
Before the second time with Apple, before the iPod. And then he made the iPhone, and the rest is history.
Exactly. I knew Chuck Colson. He was in the president's place, and Watergate sunk him, and he ended up in prison. So that when you go from everybody swinging the gates wide open for you, when you come into the White House to a number in the federal prison system, that's what I call moving from. That's failing.
Yeah.
It was seen as failing at that point, but out of it grew Prison Fellowship. So I knew him.
We'll have to let you give some Prison Fellowship background at some point.
Will do.
For those who don't know, the one that always gets me is Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
he was, you know, cut from one of his teams. I think that the story goes that it was a JV team. He was cut from.
It was ninth grade.
Imagine if you could tell that kid that got cut. And now he's probably one of the most intrinsically motivated people of all time.
Yeah.
But imagine telling that kid at that time, you're like, hey man, don't worry about this. The sport you just got cut from is going to make you a billionaire one day.
Yeah. Or even later, when he left basketball for a minute and went to baseball because his dad was a baseball fan. I mean, he had a small beginning there. He started in the minor leagues.
But think about what you even said. It was, he's one of the most like intrinsically motivated people. Would he be what he is today if he didn't get cut?
Probably. Good question.
Maybe not. And maybe that's where
he still would have been a great basketball player.
Surely.
But I don't know, like, what did that, like, flip a switch in his mind, you know?
But he spent a lot of time in the gym, too. I mean, it wasn't just he could get on the court and do things. Nobody better in disciplining himself in practice than he was, the way I understand it.
Yeah.
The way I heard it.
It's just, that story is just amazing. I mean, his motivation cost him a lot, and cost him a lot of relationships. But he was hated anything but success.
Yeah. There's some pretty big failures in the Bible.
Absolutely.
In fact,
many of the people who wrote a lot of the books were would be considered as mess. Such.
Your list is probably shorter of people who didn't have baggage.
That's correct.
I mean,
that's
a much shorter list.
I mean, the guy that wrote most of the New Testament, as far as content-wise, was Paul, or Saul.
Yeah.
And he said he was the chiefest of sinners, and he was a mess.
Absolutely.
He was a mess. In fact, it took a while for everybody to believe that he was had turned it
that, around. Yeah, that it was actually real.
Sent him away for 9 years.
Like, there's no way. There's no way.
Yeah, it sent him away for 9 years back to Tarsus. So people, most Bible scholars say so. Yeah, I mean, all you got to do is read the Bible, and you can get example after example of that. David was another.
I was going to say with David, that's the one that always makes that always gets me is David, because you know it was eventually his line that led to Jesus, and like imagine telling some people who knew David and being like, "This is the line," they'd be like,
"Yeah."
Absolutely. That's not good. That's not good at all.
Yeah. Well, the line included Rahab, too, as a prostitute. So,
I think we've done a good job drawing the line from Paul to Steve Jobs to Michael Jordan.
Hey, look at that. Yeah. Well, quite a connection.
That's the triangle that we were going for, exactly.
All known as holy people, all of the above. Yeah. So, whatever.
So, all of that just kind of leads into what we want to talk about today. Yeah. And I usually don't mention the name or the title that we're expecting to name an episode when we're talking about it. But I do kind of want to mention this one for one reason or another. And we've decided to call this episode Failure is an Option. And one of the reasons I wanted to, I guess, mention it is because we say the word failure a little bit with a little bit tongue in cheek. And one of the reasons that is because oftentimes what we consider failure is not something, God would not necessarily agree that it was failure, or he has much bigger plans to build out of that. So we want to talk today about failure being an option. And Dad, the main story that comes to my mind when I think about this sort of thing that you have is Good News Fellowship.
Yeah.
And most people who know the words Good News Fellowship, when they come out of your mouth, they think of the Good News Fellowship Conference of Churches, which is not what I mean. Tell us a little bit about the original Good News Fellowship.
Yeah. Good News Fellowship began in 1984. I was younger than you guys are. And we moved from Atmore, Alabama to Tuscaloosa, Alabama with the idea to start a church. And as we were there and we started that church in 84, the name of it was Good News Fellowship. It was a church that ended up meeting in a Ramada Inn. We rented a Ramada Inn.
A lot of churches renting out Ramada Inns these days.
Right off of
Did you Skyland name it Good News Fellowship, or was it
No, I named it Good News Fellowship. We named it Good News Fellowship. We sure did.
It's a good church name. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know if that was something that you kind of like ran into, and then you just took it from.
No, okay. I don't remember the whole process of why we named it Good News Fellowship to start with, except that we thought we had good news to share, so why not call it Good News Fellowship?
That's good.
So that's what we did. I like the ring of it. I like the ring of it, the ring of the name, and it fit what we were trying to do, share good news. And our goal was to share the good news with people that we weren't trying to go and grab up church people from other places. Our goal was to bring the good news to people who maybe were not a part of a church or part of somewhere else and move from there. That's what we did.
And the church eventually closed it started in 1984. Yeah. What year did it close?
A fall of 1986.
Okay.
I think I mentioned this maybe on a podcast earlier, but I am so good at church planting that I can start and stop a church in 3 years. It only
you
takes
said
me
two
three,
years.
Two and a half.
Two and a half years.
The spring of 84.
He's rounding up.
To the fall.
To the fall. Okay, two and a half. You're right. Yeah, two and a half.
And we weren't necessarily worshiping the whole time from 84. We started Bible studies first and so forth. We didn't really start at the Ramada Inn until maybe 85. So we were probably at the Ramada Inn maybe a year and a half. And the church grew to about 50 people. Something like that at times, not always. And some of them were a few people that had been churched and they were connected. People like Reggie, who became an elder with me, a buddy of mine that I knew from South Alabama. Ken Horst was a guy who came from Century, Florida with us to start that church. But then there were people like Greg, and there were people like Eddie and Gloria.
And What's interesting about that to me is, and you're already rattling off, a bunch of names. Before we get into some of those folks, the last day, or the last Sunday, the last service, the way you tell us is that there were 11 people in attendance.
That's correct.
And if my math is correct, about roughly somewhere in the area of 40% of those people were actually belonged to you and yourself and your immediate family.
Four of the 11 would have been. So there was Steve and there was Lenora and there was Shauna and Tanya. The four of us were there and we were four of the 11. I usually say the other seven came because they felt sorry for me. And that was our last Sunday.
You know what's interesting about, and this is not to, this is certainly not to belittle any of the, because I would say that being a pastor now is as tough as it's ever been. What happens a lot of times now, if someone plants a church and then they decide to close the doors and the final Sunday they had 11 people there, they probably are not going on to, try to help found a conference of churches, several years later, or even be a pastor again or something. So like what was your mindset like in that fall of 1986 as it pertained to future ministry?
Let's talk about depressed, anxiety ridden. Let's talk about never want to do this again. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about why did I do this to my family and uproot them when I had been pastoring a church in Atmore up until 84 that most of the people seemed to like me and the church, we had a Christian school and we had all that stuff going. So what was I thinking? Or as a close family member of mine said, after I failed to enclose the church, I failed. She said, I wasn't quite sure whether that was ever God. She said, I thought maybe it was just an adventure for you. And I thought maybe that was it. I don't know. I had a clear calling to do it, but you start questioning, did I really hear what God wanted me to do? I was convinced when we went there, I did. It was a small beginning. We didn't have much financial backing. Some, our church supported us and a missions agency supported us a little bit. But I mean, I had to have another job and I did all kinds of jobs during those two and a half, three years. I was in lawn care service. I was substitute school teaching. what else did I do?
Might be shorter of
what he didn't. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say we've gone there a couple times, but I think that might.
Yeah. So too. I did work in prison a little bit as a chaplain part time. I was doing this. I was doing that all the while, and then all the while raising your mom and I raising two girls.
So for folks out there who are having a difficult time in ministry or even leading a church, you're certainly not alone. That's correct. That has been experienced.
And if you think about it too, like the church that you're in right now, the odds are more than likely that it's going to close one day.
Yeah.
That your church, like statistics will tell you, your church is going to close one day. Now, whether it's defined as a success or not by human, by like our own, stuff, whatever the statistics are for the church. Obviously our, God is way more concerned with our obedience than he is with success and failure. And so, but I think that goes to when you talk about people like from a discouragement standpoint, it's an obedience thing more than it is success and failure because the church you're in is going to close one day.
And it's interesting because we've been talking about small beginnings, but I was thinking this week about small endings. Every church that closes usually has a small ending. Mm-hmm. Every church and almost every church closes.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And there's many doing it.
And that's not necessarily We're not talking, and I want to be clear, we're not talking about that as a bad thing.
No, yes. I understand.
You know, right. Like when we say that, that most churches close, we're not talking about like that it just being something where the people inside it didn't do well enough to keep it going.
Yeah. I knew a group of churches, Association of Churches years ago, that decided that they would only stay open for 5 years. Mm. They were formed to help plant churches. In fact, it's part of what we were a part of in the beginning stages here in Birmingham in 1986. And what they said was in their charter, I guess charter, whatever you call it, as that association, they said, we will close in 5 years.
What? That's kind of strange to me, though.
Well, the reason they said that was because their goal was to plant churches. They didn't say all the churches we started would close in 5 years. They said our function as a ministry will close in 5 years, and they said it up front. It was odd then, and it's still odd. Mm-hmm. You hardly ever hear anybody say that.
Yeah, but the idea was that they were going to leave a number of churches.
That's correct.
That didn't have that stipulation. Right?
Yes.
Okay. The churches they planted did not have the 5-year stipulation.
No, they did not.
Okay. All right. Just there. I got it.
I was working my way through the same thing.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Yeah. I wonder what would happen though, if you started a church and said, we will only be here for 5 years. That'd be kind of crazy, wouldn't it? I've never thought about that.
You know, honestly,
what could that be like?
I think in this day and age, that could be it could be more successful now than it ever could.
I think you're right. Years ago, that would have never flown, because the whole thing about church there is longevity.
Yeah,
you know, that was like a high value, was longevity.
Yeah,
but without us getting too far off track.
No, I don't think this is off track.
The only thing that I would say about that is, the longevity of a church, if that's your only thing, then you're missing the thing, because the church is not the game.
Right.
The kingdom is the game, and the church plays the game.
Yeah.
That's what a buddy of mine said many years ago, and it's helped me a lot, is the church is the team that plays the kingdom game. But if the church becomes the game, well, we can't fail. We can't stop. We can't slow down. If it's kingdom and the church is playing that kingdom game well for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, that's actually success in the eyes of God. I mean, Jesus, he had kind of a beginning and an end in terms of his ministry.
Sure.
3 years.
Yeah.
He knew he didn't have long, and wow, what was that? You know, but when he left, the disciples were like, what? Why are you leaving us, man? Yeah. And really, they still hadn't quite gotten it, you know, at the end of those 3 years. So I think some of it is maybe longevity of church is because we think it's the game.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think the kingdom, so the kingdom continues, even if that particular team, that particular group right now is moved on maybe to other teams, mm-hmm. to other places, and they're playing the kingdom game with another team kind of idea. I don't know. It's a way to look at it.
Yeah.
From a church perspective. But I didn't have that perspective in 1984, 1986. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to tell you, I didn't have that perspective. And it felt really, really, really like failure. It really felt like failure. It was painful to watch. And in the meantime, what had happened was I had burned out, or I was exhausted and I was burned out. By age 29, I didn't really want to go on. And that's when I started meeting with a pastor who himself, he was an older guy. He was 65 years old. I was almost 30. And I started meeting with him, and I started being able to sort through that experience, and some of the things that God taught me in that experience are pretty powerful. But I remember a real central point in that process of processing the failure. I had decided that I was going to go back to university, to school. I went back to a master's program in criminal justice at Alabama. I started working out 3 times a week at the UA gym. I started meeting with somebody one-on-one. There was 3 things I was going to do to kind of help me in recovery and to try to process this. And I remember after a period of maybe a month or two, I'm driving up to a stop sign coming out to Paul W. Bryant Drive, a stop sign there. Now, there's a bunch of buildings built up there now, but it was coming away from that gym where it was then. And I went up to the stop sign and I asked this question of God. I said, God, why did you allow me to come here and this happened to me? What is this about? And these are the words I heard, as clearly as if you had said them aloud to me. I heard these words because I wanted to show you that it is possible to fail without being a failure.
Mm-hmm.
So when failing is an option, it doesn't indicate that that's your identity. And I realized in that moment and through some other experiences I had after that in prayer and with this pastor, I began to realize that all my life I had dealt with a fear of failure that would be very intense for me at times. And so I would try to do things. And his words to me, he said, and I would say, well, why? I'm not a fearful person. You know, I work in prison. I do this, that, and the other. And these words were clear to me, and it became very clear to me, you know, you trusted me to start this church, and then you grabbed a hold of it to make sure it succeeded. And so you, because you had a fear of failing, you grabbed hold of things, you started doing things, and that's why I became burned out, is because I was responsible. I didn't know the rest of God, and I was working
and
way
I think
too
that,
hard.
You know, one of the things that he, I feel like that he would have been, that the Lord was driving at with that is kind of something, goes back to something that you mentioned when, you know, when we were talking about, you know, like a short-term church, like that kind of idea or whatever, right. Is when you, you were saying about how it's a, the it's about the kingdom. It's not about the church.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot of times where even now, or let me backtrack that. I was going to say something different, but I think what some things, some quote unquote speed bumps that you faced in the future that would have felt a lot bumpier if you had still been locked in on success of my church, success of my church, success of my church, as opposed to doing this because, like Derek, like you mentioned, obedience and doing it for, you know, for other people, for the kingdom, for people, like, you know, if you don't fail, you don't, you know. And I know, I don't want to rattle off a bunch of names that people don't know, but you never meet Eddie Hall, Greg Lede, you know, folks like that,
right.
Who are, you know, a big part of your story. And then if you go to Tuscaloosa, who knows if you never go to Tuscaloosa, who knows if you ever go to Birmingham, you know, where we're sitting today. And it's just,
well, that's what happened in the process of determining of over a period of time of being able to look back and see Greg and Eddie. So after our first podcast comes out this last week, one of the comments from Greg, who was one of the men that I worked with there in Tuscaloosa, was, don't forget about the stories of the 80s, because I was one of them. And he said that on Facebook, public Facebook. And I said back to him, don't worry, do we have permission to talk about that? He said, absolutely. He said, I tell that story all the time. Greg, who now lives in Milton, Florida, was a young man I met that was way off track. And in Tuscaloosa. I met him because he had lived in Tuscaloosa, but he took a little vacation down to Frankly Youth Center for about 7 months. And due to some drugs and so forth that he, and it was there that I met him, and he was coming back to Tuscaloosa. And he came back to Tuscaloosa after that little stint in Frankly Youth Center, Department of Corrections. And he came back, and for 18 months, he and I met at least once a week, sometimes several times a week. And I was able to walk with him. He was a new Christian, and I was able to disciple him. And he and his wife, Amy, live in Milton, Florida. He's been down there for many years. His story is so fantastic. I mean, it'd be worthy of having him sit in sometime just so we could have him come. And I think he'd do it.
Our people will call Greg's people. We'll make it happen.
Come on up. That's right.
Come on up, Greg. This was not on the on our, I guess, whatever list of things we had to talk about, but I feel like you mentioned enough people and maybe they're listening. Maybe a few of them are listening into this. So before we move on to the next thing, cause I think we're going to talk about kind of like that fear of the end and all that stuff and kind of what keeps you from starting stuff. of that church, of Good News Fellowship, so you said there was about a 2.5 year window. Yeah. Could you give like top three moments of the church?
Wow.
Or just in your mind, like if you're thinking highlights, right? Yeah. So what are like three things that jump out to you? It doesn't necessarily have to be an event. It could be
First one is that we move into an apartment complex and I meet Eddie Hall. I mean, that was a highlight. You know, Eddie was, he's a man who hated preachers but didn't know I was one. Mm-hmm. But I loved that relationship with him because he was a very friendly fellow. He had the second largest lawn care business in Tuscaloosa. I helped him in that business. I worked in that business with him 2 days a week. It was crazy.
How long between the start of your relationship and him joining the church?
It took a while.
You said there was 2.5 years.
It was at least 6 months.
I mean, that's pretty quick.
It was at least 6 months that he didn't know I was a preacher.
Okay.
Okay, so we were neighbors and we were back and forth. We would watch football together. We would grill out together. Mm-hmm. We were doing that. And so he would talk about how he did not like preachers. And he would just, you know, I don't like preachers, man, I don't like them. Mm-hmm. He left home when he was like 14 and was kind of independent and all that kind of stuff. And he just didn't like preachers, man. And his wife would go to church some, but he wasn't really interested because he was a Dallas Cowboys fan. So Sunday morning,
But then after 6 months, he had to grapple with the fact that he hated preachers, but realized that he liked you.
He said it. And should I just real quickly tell you, we're out grilling hamburgers, and he was grilling his hamburgers with what he called dirty dishwater. That's what he called it. Yeah, and so he's up there, and he's got it. At that point, he had a beer in his hand. I had a Pepsi in mine. Yeah. It was on a Sunday evening. I felt a little guilty about not being in church, but here I was with Eddie, and we were just doing. And he started in on preachers. And it was in that moment that God said, tell him now. So he's just ranting and raving about preachers. And I said to him, I said, Eddie, I need to tell you I am a preacher. And it was silent for a minute, and he kept putting...
He's still marinating the burger,
and he goes like this, and he looks up, he said, well, it's too late now, you're my friend. That was a powerful moment.
Yeah. All right, that so that's number one. I got a feeling that some of the people listening to this are liking that. So is there another one? Can you think of a...
Well, my relationship with Greg, I'll never forget this incident. When he came home... He worked at the University of Alabama, mm-hmm. and so we went to a basketball game. He and myself and a United Methodist preacher by the name of John Drawhorn.
That's quite a trio, right?
Yeah. Anyway, it was a trio. There we were at the ball game, and Greg, who was a wild man before he met Jesus, he was a wild man by all accounts. Mm-hmm. So, and I saw it because we go to this ball game and he goes with two preachers. Now, this is like the furthest thing from his mind. And he can't imagine going to a ball game with two preachers because when he went, he used to party. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll never forget. We're in the car leaving the Coliseum. I think we won the game. I don't remember exactly about the game. And he's just hooting and hollering and waving out the window. And I mean, he's going to town on it. And he said, man, I didn't realize I could have this much fun with two preachers. It was just a crazy moment, which kind of encapsulated for me the change in Greg. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so he and the other preacher, the United Methodist preacher, he was not a stuffy dude at all. I mean, so we were having fun.
Good.
But we were having fun, and nobody was drunk. Nobody was high. Nobody was taking anything. And that was just a moment where, like, wow. This is so unreal for him.
Yeah.
So I would say that is at least number two.
Can you round it out with the top three?
Let me go with the top three here. The top three, I think, was that moment, and this is going to sound weird. After I was coming to the end in July of 1986, I was sitting with Bick Moore, who was a pastor that I told you helped me a lot. He was a counselor. I met with him once a week for 6 months. And it was in that moment that there was feelings of false guilt that he identified with me and that we prayed for. And I received so much relief in that moment. It was crazy to describe. We don't have time for me to go into detail about what it felt like. I'll just say this. Is I realized that me, who enjoyed people, who enjoyed life, had gotten to where I didn't even like looking at anybody on the street. I was so burned out. I was so fried. Mm-hmm. But that morning, I walked to the Tuscaloosa County Courthouse where I was working as a volunteer for the Public Defender's Office in Tuscaloosa, part of my criminal justice stuff. And I had joy that I had not had in years. And I found myself speaking to everybody on the sidewalk as I walked into the Tuscaloosa County Courthouse. That's a composite of what happened to me over that summer period of time in 1986 as the church was closing. Mm-hmm. And I believe me experiencing release from that false guilt and fear of failure, both of which I had big time going on with me. In other words, if somebody I was working with messed up, I thought it was my fault prior to that time. And that's a burden, boy. That's a burden you cannot bear. And so when I got released from that, that's a top three moment. I still remember walking down the sidewalk, foolishly saying hi to everybody. Hey, how are you doing? Hey, how are you doing? And it happened like that in that morning session with that pastor when Jesus met me there. That's a top three moment.
That's great. Something that I don't think, and you can tell it just by the, because, you know, far be it from us to have to make you whittle that down to three. You did a great job. Yeah. And so I know there's plenty that's left out. But I think what I think amazes me about when kind of like rounding this all together is you don't think, we would hardly ever think about how a church closing mm-hmm. could glorify God.
That's right.
Could still give a church closing could give him the glory. And I think this did.
Eddie said years later, when he came to Birmingham as a pastor later on, and I was his supervisor as pastor to come. He said, oh, I know why you went to Tuscaloosa. He said, you had to come around and pick me up. He said, you had to come around and pick me up. Yeah. I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Had to pick Eddie up.
But it wasn't just Eddie.
Right.
Yeah. But it was Eddie. Mm-hmm. He said you had to come pick me up. That's what you had to do.
And what we lose sight of so much in, I feel like, is all of it, all of that, if just one person, if it just changes one person, then it was worth
That's
it.
Right. Enough.
Because you're talking about an eternal change, not just a change in their life right now.
That's correct.
And so when you talk about what may or may not have ever happened, if you don't go there and meet Eddie,
that's right.
We got to start dealing with different measures of success. We got to start thinking in different measures.
That's correct.
I would go so far as to say it's almost borderline. I don't know what the right word is. The only word that comes to my mind is disrespectful. It's almost borderline disrespectful in that sense to say Good News Fellowship Church was a failure.
That's right.
You know, when you're talking about you're talking about Eddie Hall.
And his whole family.
Yeah, and his whole family, you know, who now believe in, you know, and have lived their lives for Jesus since then. Other folks like Greg and, you know.
Greg, same
way. And a whole bunch of other people. It was an important tongue-in-cheek failure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And for me, I can look back on that because I have a new definition of what it means to fail. And I have a new definition of success. And I think I learned it there because I could not be doing what I'm doing in ministry now had I not been through that.
Yeah. And I think it's so important too, because I don't think I'd ever heard the part about the joy you had at the ending, and knowing that God put that there for you to, when the next task, quote unquote, came up, you know, there wouldn't be that fear.
That's
of
right.
Like, because the end somehow became when you're filled with the joy of the Lord in the end, you know, no matter what it looked like, you were ready to go for it. It made you more ready to go for the next one. I think that's an important part of it too.
And sometime we'll tell the story about what happened to me on a Sunday morning as a pastor when I got up in front of the church and said, God told me during worship that there's somebody here who needs prayer. And So I said, we'll bow our heads and we'll wait and see who it is. And I bowed my head, and as clear as crystal, God said to me, yep, and it's you. The brother tricked me. That's all yeah. I can say. He just tricked me.
This will not be the last episode covering that church.
Absolutely not.
But yeah, and it's a great example for what we're talking about.
100%. And I wanted to kind of cap it off with, you know, what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. When he, he said that his power is made perfect in our weakness. That's right. And so what we think is weakness, he is perfect, and his power is made perfect in that.
That's right.
And in our quote unquote weakness and failure, his kingdom is still growing. And so for Derek, Steve, and Chris behind the cameras, I'm Eric. This has been The Preacher in the Hat, and we will see you next time.